All right. If you like what you hear tonight, this morning, and you want to find out more about what I do, you can go to my website, strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. Everything is right there at strangeplanet.ca. You can hear me weekday afternoons, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on the it's the all-new Richard Serrett Show on News Talk Saga, 960 a.m. That's heard across the greater Toronto area. You can stream it live on saga960am.ca. And Saga, as in Mississauga, which is right next door to Toronto. Saga is spelled S-A-U-G-A, saga960am. You can find it also on Simple Radio or TuneIn. And you can listen to my weekly syndicated program, The Conspiracy Show, on AM 740 Zoomer Radio in Toronto. That's Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. And of course, my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. But the best thing, the easiest thing, is just to go to strangeplanet.ca. All right, back with more of my conversation with David Luke, PhD, the co-author of DMT Entity Encounters, Dialogues on the Spirit Molecule, right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with David Luke, PhD. We're talking about DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and ayahuasca. Have you made up your mind, David, as to whether it's possible that these DMT experiences or ayahuasca experiences are just tricks of our imagination, you know, some biochemistry in the brain, a delusion?
Well, thank you, Richard. I've made up my mind that it is possible. I think everything's possible, particularly where DMT is concerned. I try and be agnostic, though. I haven't really fully fathomed the nature of the experience, and it may be just unfathomable, really. But I'm open to all possibilities. Of course, these could be, and that would be the straightest answer, just, you know, fabrications of our own neurobiology. That doesn't fit quite satisfactorily with people who have these experiences, or even necessarily with all of the data we have about some of the extraordinary facets of the experience that occur with DMT and ayahuasca. So I think there's a lot we can learn, if nothing else, about the nature of consciousness and the mind and brain and their relationship through studying ayahuasca and DMT. I think we're going to learn a lot, whatever conclusions we come to. And I think it may always remain somewhat of a mystery.
Do we have the tools to find out?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think neuroscience has made some great strides in recent decades. But, you know, collectively, we still have no idea what consciousness even is, what, you know, existence is, what it is, what being is. You know, these fundamental questions about the nature of reality remain elusive. We may kind of get better at mapping the brain and drill further and further down into the neurobiology, but it's increasing complexity as we go, and we get further and further away in some respects, like a chimera, in terms of explaining what consciousness is. So I think we have to be humble and open-minded. We have to get away from this kind of arrogance of science that we can readily explain everything. And I think we have to be open to the possibility of all interpretations, including those of indigenous people who've been making use of these substances for thousands of years.
Are there any cases where, I don't know if the word sober is the proper term to describe someone who has not consumed ayahuasca, and yet they are, let's say, present at a ceremony? Has there ever been any overlap so that even though they are sober, they are having some experiences simply by being in the presence of this ceremony?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not everyday occurrence that people in an ayahuasca ceremony are not taking ayahuasca, but on those occasions where people are sitting in on other people's experiences, there can be a kind of what we might call a contact high or hitchhiking experience, whereby people in the presence of other people in these states also go somewhere, you know, that they have a journey themselves, particularly if they're perhaps quite open or sensitive to that. That's a well-known trope of psychedelia, of the underground for decades. How that occurs, we don't know. I mean, it could just be an heightened empathy, but people do often hitchhike on other people's psychedelic experiences for free.
Hmm. Would that be similar to a placebo effect?
I guess we have to couch it in that kind of territory in some respects. I think it goes a little deeper than that. I think you were probably in the realm of a placebo. But the placebo is you have the expectation of having a psychedelic experience, and therefore you have one. With a hitchhiking, you know, contact high, you probably don't have any expectation of having a psychedelic-like experience, and people are often startled when it occurs. It's just being in the presence of people in that expanded state can be contagious.
When I was reading the book, I came across something very, well, it's all interesting, but something I hadn't even considered, and that is that, you know, when we think of drugs, one builds a tolerance to certain drugs. You have to take more of it to get the same effect. But with ayahuasca, there seems to be the exact opposite. I think it's referred to as a reverse tolerance. Explain.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is one of the reasons why psychedelics are considered perhaps not to be addictive. There is with DMT in particular, there's this reverse tolerance effect. So actually, you don't build up a tolerance to the drug. If you take a big dose and then you take another big dose shortly afterwards, it doesn't diminish the intensity of the second experience. And in fact, people may become more sensitive to it. So often, you know, ayahuasca shamans, we're called ayahuasqueros, will only take a minute dose of the ayahuasca, and they still are able to have this intense expanded experience. And in some ways, we see that from very limited research, which has shown that, you know, you can reinduce almost totally full-blown psychedelic experiences through hypnotic inductions. So we are accessing a part of our mind which we can connect with, and the substance is only part of the way of getting there. It's the kind of key to the lock, but then a door is somehow left open, and that's an intriguing thing about this reverse tolerance effect.
Is there a difference between the ayahuasca derived from the mixture of certain plants and the synthetic form, if there is such a thing?
That's also a kind of issue of great debate. So when you take the mixture, you are getting more than one chemical. You're getting lots of other chemicals as well. From the ayahuasca vine itself doesn't contain DMT, it contains MAO inhibitors, a different kind of chemical. So you're actually getting very different chemicals when you drink ayahuasca as opposed to synthetic DMT, for instance. But people also talk about there being an entourage effect, so it's a kind of the synergy of those different chemicals. But also people talk who are advocates of a more shamanic perspective and whole plant aficionados, they refer to the spirit of it as well. It's like it's not just a drug or a chemical or a collection of plants. It's like there is a relationship there that the people who harvest the ayahuasca sing to the plants. They pray, they make songs, they set up a dialogue and communication to the spirit of ayahuasca. And you don't get any of that in the kind of synthetic drug. And it may be that that isn't necessarily relevant, but it's something that can't easily be brought into the laboratory. So there's a whole discussion and debate around, yeah, our relationship to molecules as opposed to plants.
In other words, it could be the spirit of the plant rather than the molecule itself.
Well, the molecule itself definitely does something that's not quibbled about, really. You know, if you just take synthetic DMT, you'll have an extremely powerful experience, but the nature of the experience may be colored by the way in which it's prepared, the combination of plants that are used, and it's quite a high art in the Amazon. You know, there are literally hundreds of different admixtures they put into the ayahuasca. There's different, you know, subspecies of plants they use. There's different combinations, there's different brews, there's different prayers. No two ayahuascas are the same, and different shamans will have their different ways of making it. So it's almost impossible to repeat the kind of the ayahuasca experience in a laboratory way. There's just too many factors involved. And so, you know, synthetic DMT is a crude simulacra for actual ayahuasca in many respects.
I'm not sure, in the dialogues, I'm not sure who brought this point up, whether it was Angela Voss or Luna, who we've been talking about. And that is that someone said that the medicine, I think was the term they used, the medicine gives you what you need, not what you want. What does that mean?
That's a very common trope as well in these kind of experiences. So you may have some expectations about, or even intentions about, what you want to get from the experience. But the experience takes you on the ride, and you may not necessarily have much control over that. So you don't necessarily get what you want, but often the experience you do get, even if it is kind of very challenging, which it often is very challenging, you come out of it feeling renewed, you know, better, having perhaps resolved some issues, often very dramatically. You know, people can overcome decades of trauma and depression in one sitting. So you don't necessarily get what you want, you know, something nice and fluffy and dreamy and beatific, but you often get what you need, which is some kind of revelation or process or insight about things that have happened in your life.
Do you, is there any research to suggest that, let's say, the oracles in Greece, the Oracle of Delphi, or saints in the Bible, or figures in the Old Testament who claim to have, you know, communication with the divine, that DMT may have played a role in that?
Right, well, quite possibly. I mean, certainly the oracles of Delphi, there's evidence to suggest they were kind of high on psychoactive gases coming up from the fissures in the rock. There's a possibility they also imbibed the plant henbane, which was sacred to the Apollo, was named Pythonian. The ladies, the seeresses were called the Pythia. There's a lot of kind of etymological evidence to suggest they were actually taking tropane alkaloid plants, which are quite different to DMT, but psychoactive plants nonetheless. But in terms of other experiences, other saints and mystics and visionaries, you could perhaps compare their experiences with DMT, as Rick Strassman has done. He wrote a book, DMT, The Soul of Prophecy, I believe, and he compared the visionary experiences of the prophets of the Old Testament to DMT experiences, kind of like stack them up side by side, and you can see there is a great degree of overlap in these kind of experiences. And he puts forward the idea that they were having spontaneous DMT experiences produced by their own DMT in their body. It's circumstantial and you know, theoretical, but it's a fairly compelling story. DMT could be the reality thermostat that Strassman talks about, that it is perhaps key in spontaneous mystical experiences and visionary experiences. We're yet to get to the bottom of that, but it is totally possible.
In a previous book, it was another bringing together of various people to discuss the DMT. One of those was Rupert Sheldrake. This was, I guess, in 2015. And he was talking about morphogenetic fields. What are morphogenetic fields?
Well, I'll give you my interpretation of Rupert's fantastic theory. So he posits that consciousness itself has like a field-like effect, as in the same kind of way as electromagnetic fields in physics, but that it resonates through time, so that I guess in a way in which, you know, we might think about Jungian archetypes, so that certain experiences of consciousness leave a kind of indelible imprint in a kind of collective field, which can be tapped into. And this explains habits that we see occurring in biology as well. So that if people collectively come together and pray in a similar kind of way over a period of time to a similar deity, then people later can also do those prayers and have experiences of that deity, perhaps as they were originally conducted in times past by. So that our sum total collective of our experience and our biology as it currently is built upon these fields, these morphogenetic fields, which emanate through biology and consciousness in time.
So with ayahuasca. Sorry.
That's my best attempt.
Okay. So with ayahuasca, what is it's creating an energetic field that then would do what?
So in that respect, you know, we could explore it as a means to understand and explain why people have encounters with serpents whenever they drink ayahuasca, well, not often when they drink ayahuasca, whether or not they come from the Amazon where serpents are imbued in their cosmology, or whether or not they come from, you know, Ontario or wherever it may be and have gone to the Amazon and drank ayahuasca. It could be that people are tapping into this morphic field, which is associated with this chemical. So there is, in the theory of morphogenetic fields, it's all about resonance. So if there's a resonance through time with things that are similar to that. So in the case of drinking ayahuasca, you are having a resonance with the field of all the previous ayahuasca experiences that people have had.
Any evidence or data to suggest that behaviors, and we're approaching a break here, so we'll just throw the question out and we'll come back and discuss further, but that there are permanent changes to behavior after an ayahuasca experience, like addiction, for example?
Yeah, often. And in fact, you know, these substances like ayahuasca, like psilocybin, have been shown to have some of the most impressive beneficial behavioral changes, such as addiction. You know, in one study with tobacco cessation, they found that something like two-thirds of the sample of people who took part in that study had quit smoking for up to a year later. They followed them up a year later. Two-thirds of them were given up smoking from one high dose of psilocybin, i.e. magic mushrooms, which is, you know, astonishingly greater than the next most efficacious intervention treatment out there for tobacco cessation. These things are extraordinarily effective in reducing addictions, but also in treating depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, end of life, existential anxiety, and so on.
All right. We'll take another time out, David. Stay put. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines, questions and comments for Dr. David Luke on DMT. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Tucked into the House of Representatives' lengthy fiscal 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed last week, is a provision to form a permanent office under the defense secretary where officials would investigate government and military provided reports of unexplained sights in the sky. The office would carry out on a department-wide basis the mission currently performed by the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force, according to a less than five-page section in the House's NDAA, which was put forth by Representative Ruben Gallego, the Democrat from Arizona, a Marine Corps combat veteran. The U.S. government, of course, has a rocky history of grappling with flying saucers and other mysterious water and aircraft. Predated by the Hush-Hush Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program in the mid-aughts, Defense Department's UAP task force was formed more recently after mounting public pressure and the release and authentication of videos depicted by Navy pilots engaging with what appeared to be UFOs. An unclassified 9-page preliminary assessment of the UAPTF released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in June confirmed that more than 140 reports of UAP-associated observations originated from government sources in recent years, 80 of which were further validated via multiple sensors. All right, you can read more of that story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, your questions and comments for David Luke, PhD, as we continue to discuss dimethyltryptamine and ayahuasca right here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, welcome back. Let's dive right into the phone calls, and we'll go to the wildcard line. And Joshua is in Eureka, California. Joshua, you're on the line with David Luke. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have experienced the DMT experience. I want to say that I was on the forefront of the new modern psychedelic revolution, because we had heard about DMT from the 60s and all that, and then it just disappeared. And then it was like 1998, I want to say, where somebody somehow was able to procure this for us, and it started becoming available on the so-called psychedelic scene. And in that time, it just became more and more available until modern times, where it just seems like everybody has it and everybody's trying and experimenting with it. So what my that's just some comment I'm making. But my question is that I've noticed that in my experience, comparing the mushroom experience of psilocybin mushrooms to DMT, that DMT feels something that's connected more to a universal consciousness, more cosmic, whereas the mushroom experience was more connected to the earth and nature itself. And I'm wondering if you have experienced the same.
Great question, Joshua. David?
Thank you for that, Joshua. Well, I mean, I could talk about my personal experiences, but I think this is, anyway, that's something that people report quite generally, that DMT is seemingly a lot more artificial and alien, and yet at the same time somehow organic, like organic and mechanic and, you know, extra dimensional, whereas psilocybin and mushroom experiences are more sonic, you know, more earthly. They are very similar chemically. So like psilocybin is 4-hydroxy-DMT. It's like the fungal world's version of the other kind of DMT, which is found in animals and plants. And the experiences can be quite similar, but it's always hard to get away from the context, right? If you're taking psilocybin, it's almost always something that's been grown organically and people have picked and handled, and it has a story attached to it. Whereas DMT is often, you know, just this crystal formulation that people have made in their own kitchens. And that's part of the reason why it's much more prolific now, is because information about quite simple kitchen chemistry is proliferated and everybody's making it. So it's a bit hard to separate out what is the chemical effect and what's the cultural context in which it's occurring, and what's the other stuff, you know, what's coming from the raw experience, the morphic field, if you like, and is driving the kind of experience that people have. But yes, I would agree that people tend to say that DMT is more cosmic and mushrooms are more earthly. I was going to add something to that, is that I've been really looking at the sense in which psychedelics can drive people to have a connection with nature, increasing their ecological consciousness or nature connectedness. And mushrooms are, you know, top of the charts, hands down, win every time. When you ask people what one psychedelic substance has made them feel more connected to nature, it's magic mushrooms by head and shoulders.
Joshua, thank you for that. A number of years ago, I was working on a radio documentary series for our national broadcaster up here in Canada. And I traveled down to, it was the UCLA Medical Center. And I spoke with a doctor, Groban, I think his name was. It's been quite a few years, but he was experimenting with psilocybin for end-of-life anxiety. And I interviewed some of the patients under his care who had things like terminal cancer. And they described the experience of psilocybin where it's like the ego disappears to the point where they almost disappeared, which can be kind of, you know, a disturbing thing to happen, you know, if you're not anticipating that. Is that similar to an experience with DMT or ayahuasca? Does the ego disappear?
That's a great question, and thanks for mentioning Charles Grob's amazing work. Patients and psilocybin. They had extraordinary success in reducing kind of end-of-life fear and anxiety and depression, often through these ego dissolution experiences, which is, you know, quite common to psilocybin. Interestingly, with DMT and ayahuasca, you can get a lot of ego dissolution, but there's always an I. Nearly always, there's always an I and another, or at least when you start to dissolve your ego, another usually comes along, and it's always often experienced as something external to you. You know, you are encountering another, so you never get total ego dissolution. I don't think with DMT, at least that people can remember. Sometimes people just have too much and don't remember anything. But there's always a sense of your identity is still there, even if you can't remember your name or who you are. There is an I, you know. And so this total dissolution doesn't tend to occur with DMT, which is interesting because that's one of the kind of the key components of what people think psychedelic experiences are.
Right. I remember a conversation with one patient. Now he said I was on a boat in the middle of the ocean. The ocean disappeared, then the boat disappeared, and then I disappeared. Let's go back to the phones, and let's see. Joe is in Monterey on the wildcard line. Joe, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Richard. I've been noticing for many years, and I am a contactee, by the way, but I've noticed that some of the structures on the planet are conducive to extraterrestrial involvement. Also, what if you were traveling to a planet and you wanted to have some food and drink there waiting for you? Wouldn't you teach the culture to grow something that may be more entertaining for the extraterrestrials, like extracurricular drugs, but also to make contact with ET and human beings as well?
Oh, that's interesting. So, David, is it possible, while we're into the realm of pure speculation here, that ETs may have given us ayahuasca or DMT in order to make contact?
That's a really interesting notion. I'm going to be very open to all possibilities here. It would be a good joke, I think, if they were to do that. And you know, if I was an extraterrestrial with hyperintelligence, I might leave something like DMT for a less evolved species to discover and open up a dialogue. It's permissible, and this is often one of the revelations or conclusions that people kind of come to when they have DMT experiences. And you know, there is an overlap between the abduction contactee UFO phenomena and DMT phenomena. Obviously, it doesn't necessarily account for UFO experiences, but in terms of alien contact experiences, there's a massive degree of overlap. It could be that DMT explains alien contact experiences to some extent, but then what are DMT experiences when it feels like you're having real direct contact with aliens? We haven't really explained that. So, you know, DMT may be part of the explanation, but that explanation only goes so far, and from that point on, it's speculation.
Mayat is in New York this morning. Mayat, welcome.
Good morning, gentlemen. An excellent, intriguing, and fascinating show again, Richard. And also, aloha greetings to the beloved community. A brief comment to the wife for my question, and I'll listen over the iHeart. Last night on Coast, Lisa Gar had a guest, Christian Van Laar, and he was a master clairvoyant. He gave us a one-on-one on nature spirits, leprechauns, elves, gnomes, and what was the other one? Fairies. And so when you mentioned your experience with these little beings, especially since he explained that there's some extensive history in Europe where you are, and Iceland actually closes down a traffic intersection because they understand that's a gnome crossing. So I'd like you to tell us if you looked into which nature spirits, are you open to the idea of nature spirits? And if you hadn't thought about it, would you, and would you report back to us? And I'll listen over the iHeart. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maya. All right, David?
Thank you very much for that question, Maya. There is, again, a massive degree of overlap with these encounter experiences with psychedelics, particularly DMT, but also magic mushrooms, and people having encounters with little people, which before we knew about DMT and psilocybin in the West, in the industrialized world, people were having these experiences. There's a massive body of folklore. People like Evans Wentz collected hundreds of stories from around Britain and Ireland about 100 years ago of encounters with the little people, you know, pixies, elves, gnomes. And so we have to draw upon that literature in trying to understand DMT experiences and psilocybin experiences, and that we could possibly interpret it that people traditionally, before we knew about DMT, were having these encounters, but perhaps having some kind of spontaneous DMT experience. And again, that only gives us part of the explanation, just the biological bit. When it gets interesting is you can have one of these experiences on your own. You can take DMT and you've got a fairly good chance of encountering a little person. As Terence McKenna said, you know, you get elves, everybody does. Well, not quite everybody, but it's a very common experience. But it gets more interesting when people collectively are having these experiences. So there's on one occasion I had with, I'm involved peyote, and we're in a location, and a friend and I both had an identical experience, or, you know, very, very similar experiences of what we could only describe as gnomes, seeing gnomes, because they came out of the ground. There's like a portal opened up in my experience, a portal opened up in the ground and appeared to be these very bizarre looking, almost kind of scary, very weird little people coming out of this portal in the ground. And I wasn't communicating this to anybody at the time, but then chatting to my friend who'd been in the ceremony with me, she had an identical experience. You know, she described experiencing the very same thing. So is it something about that location? Was it just some kind of telepathic experience? Was it just a coincidence? Was it just our biology? I think we have to kind of explore all of those. But, you know, there is a long tradition in the folklore of certain locations having certain types of little people. You know, there are stories abound in the folklore that, you know, orchards, for instance, will have their own little breed of orchard pixies and so on and so forth. Is this just all kind of fairy tales and myths and stuff we tell to kids, or is there something to be really seriously explored here? And I think the latter.
Mayat, great call, great question. Thank you. Just to have a little over a minute here, very quickly, microdosing with certain psychedelics is becoming increasingly popular. Does microdosing DMT have any effect, or do you have to take a certain dosage?
Well, okay, there's again, a big controversy here around microdosing. What's really interesting is that the microdosing technically is taking a dose of a psychedelic on a kind of daily basis, like a psychovitamin, but at a dose which you can't feel immediately the subjective experience, but, you know, you somehow have a better day, or you're concentrating more, or you feel less depressed, or you're more creative, but that you're not tripping, okay? And when we look at people's self-reports, you know, when you survey people about their experiences with microdosing, you know, the majority of people say, yeah, it was really positive, really beneficial, et cetera, et cetera. And yet when we do the clinical drug trials where we have a placebo control condition, people still report the same positive experience, but they also report the same positive experience with a placebo. So it could be a large expectation effect. That's what the clinical evidence would suggest. But at the same time, I'm just going to add to that, there is research suggesting, you know, good scientific research showing that psychedelics enhance what's called like neuroplasticity. They help create new brain cells. They have a direct biological change in the brain in a positive way of generating new brain connections and cells and dendrites and so on. And DMT, even at microdose levels, has this neurogenesis effect. It helps create brain cells. So there may well be some beneficial effects of microdosing psychedelics like DMT, but that the subjective experience is kind of indistinguishable from placebo.
Got it. David, fascinating discussion. I hope you'll come back and we can discuss again sometime. David Luke, DMT Entity Encounters. All right. Taking us into the break, Turn Your Love by Half Moon Run, the Juno Award-winning band from Montreal. Open Lines coming up next here on Coast to Coast AM.